News.
Today is Friday, December 10th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. and Israeli military leaders voice strong concern over Iran's nuclear weapons advances.
I'm deeply concerned about the Iranian government's nuclear actions in recent months, both its continued provocations and its lack of constructive diplomatic engagement.
Plus, President Joe Biden closes 2 days virtual summit for democracy with a push for election integrity and bolstering independent media.
It remains to be seen just how real and how sustainable the results of this summit will be going forward.
Also, a British appellate court has opened the door for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States. Our top story today is in the U.S. U.S. and Israeli military leaders voiced strong concern at a Pentagon meeting about Iran's nuclear advances on Thursday. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, in a meeting with Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz, said he was deeply concerned about Iran's lack of constructive diplomatic engagement and cautioned that President Joe Biden was, quote, prepared to turn to other options, unquote, if the current American policy on Iran fails.
I'm deeply concerned about the Iranian government's nuclear actions in recent months, both its continued provocations and its lack of constructive diplomatic engagement. The president has made clear that if diplomacy fails, we are prepared to turn to other options. The Department of Defense will continue to work closely with all of our partners throughout the region, including Israel first and foremost, to ensure that we're working together to address Iranian threats. We will defend ourselves, we will defend our friends, and we will defend our interests. Such normalization efforts are a major strategic opportunity. So we will continue to buttress this emerging regional security architecture through military-to-military cooperation, training, and joint exercises.
That's U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz expressed the goal of deepening dialogue on joint military readiness to be able to halt Iran's regional aggression and nuclear aspirations.
Anticipate a productive discussion, particularly in areas of cooperation between DOD and MOD. I look forward to continuing our dialogue with the administrations on plans for defense acquisition to maintain Israel's security. Israel operational superiority will not only guarantee the safety of our citizens, but will also enable us to leverage the positive trends in the region. Only a strong, secure Israel can extend its hand in peace to its neighbors. Only a strong and secure Israel can expand the Abraham Accords and normalization, deepen our ties with Jordan and Egypt, and build confidence with our Palestinian neighbors. The nuclear program is a means to Iran's hegemonic goals, imposing its radical ideology and threatening Israel's existence. I am totally confident in the commitment of the administration of the United States as a global power to prevent Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon.
That's Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz. Indirect talks between Iran and the United States on salvaging the 2015 Iran nuclear deal took place on Thursday in Vienna. The U.S. State Department said Thursday the Biden administration is moving to tighten enforcement of sanctions against Iran with the dispatch of a senior delegation to the United Arab Emirates next week. The move comes as the UAE, a U.S. ally, works to improve ties with Iran in a bid to contain regional tensions and amid Western doubts about Tehran's determination to salvage the 2015 nuclear agreement. Under the deal, Iran agreed with major powers that it would curb its nuclear program in return for the lifting of economic sanctions. After former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the deal and reimposed sanctions, Iran started violating the nuclear restrictions. Tehran denies seeking nuclear weapons. President Joe Biden is looking to close his 2-day virtual summit for democracy on Friday by shining a spotlight on election integrity, countering authoritarian regimes, and bolstering independent media. On the summit's first day, Biden on Thursday announced plans for the U.S. to spend $424 million around the world to support independent media, anti-corruption work, and more. The initiative came as he called on world leaders to work with him to reverse what he called an alarming diminishment of democracy around the globe. For more on the summit, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara.
From the United States side, there is a certain sense of humility that can be seen from President Joe Biden's remarks when he said that we know as well as anyone else that democracy needs constant effort and constant renewal. He did not mention President Trump by name. He did not mention the events of January 6th, where Trump supporters stormed the Capitol to overturn the result of the election. But I think it's quite clear that what he means is that, as well as other Democratic backsliding that's happened in the U.S. Now, the United States has announced what is called the Presidential Initiative for Democratic Renewal. This is a series of foreign assistance initiatives, about $420 million in the coming year, and this is subject to congressional approval. This supports everything from independent media, anti-corruption efforts, empowering labor unions and marginalized groups, advancing technology towards democracy, those kinds of initiatives. And then beyond that, there are also some leaders who are making their own pledges and commitments towards democracies. But again, these are not legally binding. Of course, they will have to sell it to their own constituencies at home. So it remains to be seen just how real and how sustainable the results of this summit will be going forward.
The summit wraps today. What do you think its achievement has been?
There wasn't really any kind of concrete goal at the start of the summit other than to get democracies together and talk about their problems and the best way to go forward. They divided into these pillars of human rights, anti-corruption, and so on. But the fact is that there's not even communique, as is very common at the end of a summit. There's no joint statement. The senior administration official say that they just see the summit as really a launch of the work that's to come, and they didn't want to get ahead of themselves. There is going to be, or at least planned, of an in-person summit about a year from now. But when I asked them whether they had any plans to continue this platform beyond the Biden administration, the answer was that there was no plan. So what's the goal? The goal was to get like-minded countries, democracies together to talk about how to strengthen, how to renew democracies. Whether or not that goal can be achieved has to be seen going forward. I'm sure the backsliding of democracies, which has happened in the past 15 years, according to a report by Freedom House, is likely to continue. And I don't think the summit is likely to change that. But the hope is at least there is a platform where democracies can talk about the best way forward in terms of strengthening their own, as well as trying to stop the expansion and the influence of authoritarian regimes who want to export authoritarian tendencies in many parts of the world.
Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., tells VOA Carol Van Dam that he thinks Biden is holding a summit now to take stock of the challenges that democratic governments worldwide are facing.
An effort to rekindle and recommit to democratic principles among the world's democracies, and recognizing that the way that these countries operate and rights responsibilities for their citizens is different than in autocracies. And this has implications for international governance in terms of security, respect for human rights, and respecting the rule of law.
And one of the things that the State Department also mentioned as their aim for this summit for democracy is to eliminate corruption in a lot of these governments where there's emerging democracies. That seems to be under threat in many countries. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, corruption is a issue for good governance under all systems. And it's a huge impediment for development. It's a key factor in security and instability in many countries around the world. Corruption is a big challenge in democracies and democratizers because people have higher expectations of their government. Now, fortunately, in those systems, when they operate correctly, there's more transparency and accountability, and there's mechanisms to deal with corruption. You know, democracies don't assure that you don't have corruption, but they provide means to deal with it. And in doing so, they provide a more effective platform from which you can deal with the issues of economic development, poverty alleviation, and economic stability more generally.
It would seem that this summit is also being held at a time when China and Russia in particular are exerting a lot of influence on the African continent. Would you agree with that? Is that kind of the aim as well of this summit?
I don't think that's a direct aim of the summit. I think the summit is really aimed at, from a positive standpoint, reaffirming democratic principles and trying to bring like-minded countries together to reflect on the state of democracy and what could be done to help enhance it. Now, it is true that we've seen more assertive authoritarian influences in Africa, and I think Russia stands out in this regard, in that it has actively tried to seek out various authoritarian and isolated leaders on the continent as a means of co-opting their support and therefore enhancing its influence. And we've seen this in the Central African Republic. They're making efforts to do so in Mali and in Sudan. Russia's vying to have influence in Libya. We're also seeing the Gulf states, United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia in particular, Qatar to a lesser extent, trying to vie for influence in some of the northern and Eastern African countries, and in the process, reasserting authoritarian norms. And so again, in Sudan and in Tunisia, they have been very active, and we're seeing them vie for influence in the Horn of Africa. So this is certainly a factor that's shaping today's governance environment in Africa. It isn't a neutral playing field. There are external actors that are very much trying to bring Africa back to a more authoritarian governance model.
That's Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Washington on Thursday. A federal appeals court has ruled against former President Donald Trump's effort to shield documents from the House Committee investigating the June 16 insurrection at the Capitol. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Federal appeals court has ruled against former President Donald Trump's efforts to shield documents from the House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. I'm Ben Thomas with the latest. The three-judge panel says there's a unique legislative need for the documents. The former president has sought to block their release, claiming executive privilege. But the appeals court ruled the injunction preventing the National Archives from turning them over will expire in 2 weeks, or when the Supreme Court rules on an expected appeal from Trump, whichever is later. The National Archives says the records include presidential diaries, visitor logs, speech drafts, handwritten notes concerning the events of January 6th from the files of former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and a draft executive order on the topic of election integrity. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been able to maintain good relations with his Ukrainian and Russian counterparts, but now analysts warn that escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine could end that balancing act. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
As tensions rise between Ukraine and Russia, Turkey is caught in the middle. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has cultivated close ties with both his Ukrainian and Russian counterparts. Mustafa Aydın teaches international relations at Turkey's Kadir Has University.
Turkey has developed a quite close relationship with Russia in different localities and neighborhoods of Turkey. But Ukraine has always been, since its independence, one of Turkey's closer, friends and allies, in fact. If there is a conflict there, Turkey would be in a very hard position not to take sides.
Touting his good relations, Erdogan is offering to mediate between Kiev and Moscow, a move welcomed by Kiev. But a Russian foreign ministry spokesperson dismissed the offer. Some analysts say Moscow will be wary of damaging its close ties with Ankara. They say Russia values those ties, given that Turkey is a member of NATO.
For Russia, it's a priority to deepen cleavages within the NATO community. Turkey is very important for Russia, and deepening its contact with Ankara, Russia deepens cleavages within of NATO.
But Moscow's patience with Ankara could be wearing thin. Turkey's recent decision to let a U.S. warship use Istanbul's Bosphorus waterway to participate in a NATO-Ukrainian naval exercise in April drew swift condemnation from Russian President Vladimir Putin. Turkey's continued sale of military drones to Ukraine, which Kiev used recently against Russian-backed separatist forces, drew further criticism from Moscow. Arda Mevlutoğlu is an independent defense analyst.
Russia would like to see the breakup of Turkey from NATO in this topic, in this conflict. Therefore, the support, the existence of Turkish support to Ukraine itself would be a key concern for Russian decision makers.
Turkey is heavily dependent on Russian energy and cooperation in hotspots, including Syria. Ankara is thus aware that Moscow could extract a heavy price if Ankara sides with its NATO partners in a conflict over Ukraine. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
French President Emmanuel Macron on Friday welcomed Germany's new Chancellor Olaf Scholz for an inaugural working meeting at the LSE Presidential Palace in Paris. The two most powerful EU leaders will begin the search for common ground to tackle issues within the bloc and beyond. Heading the agenda, French officials say it will be tensions over Ukraine, with U.S. officials believe could face Russian invasion early next year, and Macron's priorities for France's six-month European Union presidency, which starts on January 1st. Analysts say Scholz faces several problems that could determine how quickly he's able to win over the German public and consolidate on the successes of his predecessor. For more on his priorities, I spoke with reporter Henry Ridgewell, who covered the campaign and Scholz's election.
The things he's got to fight, first of all, are, number one, the COVID crisis in Germany. Of course, all European countries have been through several waves of the crisis, and there were indications earlier in the year that Germany may have come through this very well. Infections were low, take-up of the vaccine was high, and there was a hope that perhaps we were in the final leg of the crisis. But in the past few weeks, as in many other European countries, infection rates and hospitalization rates in Germany have skyrocketed. In fact, it's got the highest infection rate in Western Europe currently, with around 80,000 infections a day. So that remains the immediate crisis that the new government will have to face. But it's not only domestic policy as well. If you look not very far east, there are several tens of thousands of Russian troops massed on the Ukrainian border. And Germany, along with the United States and other Western European countries, have joined forces to warn Russia of severe economic consequences in the case of any Russian invasion of Ukraine. So it's a real baptism of fire for the new coalition government. It's taken several months for them to agree on their coalition policies, and we'll see in the coming weeks and months how that will play out and how well they can work together.
He has big shoes to fill with influence and clout of the former Chancellor Angela Merkel, not just in Germany, not just in Europe, but in the world. And how long does he have in this romance before people really start paying attention and holding him accountable?
I don't think he will have the sort of political honeymoon that many leaders might enjoy. Of course, we've had nearly 17 years of the rule of Chancellor Merkel in Germany, and people have got very used to her, not only in Germany, but in Europe and around the world. She's been one of the rocks, one of the foundations, if you like, of Western democracy. But as we have been discussing, those crises that Germany must face immediately, Olaf Scholz and his government will be judged very quickly on how well they will deal with the winter COVID crisis. There is a new foreign minister in place as well, Annalisa Baerbock. She's from the Green Party. She is thought to be more hawkish towards Russia and China than Chancellor Merkel was, who was often accused of putting German trade before foreign policy and before security concerns that other European and Western leaders had. So there are these benchmarks to which the government will be judged very quickly. So I think by January, February, we'll see whether the government's response to COVID, whether it will be more restrictions on people's movements, whether it will be mandatory vaccines, which is another concern that the government has to deal with very quickly, the people of Germany will be judging them very quickly.
What kind of a man is the new chancellor? Does he have that personal touch, that personal warmth, that in diplomacy might even just be the difference between success and failure?
He is a softly spoken man, but one with experience. So in Germany, there isn't the sort of history of charismatic leaders, I suppose, that you might see in other Western democracies. Chancellor Merkel prided herself on her judgment, her calmness, and that is the way that the German government has carried itself out. And Olaf Scholz essentially billed himself as the continuity candidate, despite coming from the rival Social Democrats Party. He has sort of said that he is the continuity for Chancellor Merkel, and people voted along those lines. So although change is coming to Germany, it is change with a very small C. And he has been vice chancellor, of course, as well in Angela Merkel's government. So he does have that experience. He is well known internationally because of that. He was also mayor of the city of Hamburg when the G20 was held a few years ago. Generally, he is seen as a capable pair of hands, an experienced politician, one who's not going to bring through dramatic changes either to Germany's domestic policy in terms of its taxation and so on, or in terms of Germany's outlook on the world and its foreign policy.
That's reporter Henry Ridgewell speaking with me from London. This is the Voice of America. A British appellate court has opened a door for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States. The High Court in London overturned a lower court that found Assange's mental health was too fragile to withstand the American penal system. A judge earlier this year refused the U.S. request to extradite Assange to face spying charges over WikiLeaks' publication of secret military documents a decade ago. That judge said Assange was likely to kill himself if held under harsh U.S. prison conditions. The appellate court ruled Friday that U.S. assurances were enough to guarantee Assange would be treated humanely. Assange's fiancée says the decision will be appealed. The top U.S. commander for the Middle East says the U.S. will keep 2,500 troops in Iraq for the foreseeable future, despite their shift to a non-combat role, and they will still provide air support and other military support for Iraq's continuing fight against Islamic State. Marine General Frank McKenzie said in an interview with the Associated Press at the Pentagon that Iran-backed militias want all Western forces out of Iraq and expects there will be increasing attacks on the U.S. and Iraqis in the coming weeks in an effort to get them out. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The two journalists who shared this year's Nobel Peace Prize have received their awards during a ceremony in Norway. Maria Ressa of the Philippines and fellow laureate Dmitry Muratov of Russia gave their Nobel lectures at Oslo City Hall on Friday. Both warned that the world needs independent reporting to counter the power of authoritarian governments. The Norwegian Nobel Committee awarded them the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize for their fights for freedom of expression in countries where reporters have faced persistent attacks, harassment, and killings. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Makwaya Barrow, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I am Jeanette Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant weekend.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa.
So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to sikus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09.